but I'm half forward to it.
Sendit started in the early 1970s by a group of young people who were concerned with social issues and who had a background in the film society movement and had an attachment to the cinema as such. And there was a belief that cinema, the moving image, needed to be demystified and given democratized, giving people access to media. Now, everything is within a certain social context, of course, certain period of time. Now, if you remember in the 1970s, the audiovisual media's reach was very limited. Yeah. You had Vivid Bharti, Akashvani, and then you had the Bombay Cinema. Basically, that's it. And of course, some regional cinemas also. But they were all centralized. Everything was made in one place and then beamed all over the country. So two things we thought needed change. One is production needed to be decentralized. And the next step was the people who make it also needed to be people. We thought films were too important to be left to filmmakers, but people who are concerned with issues should be trained, taught, encouraged to make their own productions about issues that matter to their community, their neighborhood. So at that time, our first endeavor was really in the field of research. So we tried to examine how films were perceived by rural folk and what the distribution mechanism was for films. So it was very limited. Basically, there was, I even forget the name, there was this unit of the information of broadcasting.
Film Division.
Film Division, or the producer, but there's an organization which went occasionally to villages and showed Film Division documentaries and stuff like that. So we did research in villages, how people perceived those documentaries, how they responded to them, and how well distributed they were. So of course, seeing the way films were produced, the amount of investment required, the kind of equipment needed, we soon felt that there was a need to explore alternative methods, alternative technologies. So we discovered Super 8. That was our first technological sort of input, was Super 8. You have a small camera, and portable, you can carry it everywhere. And there were people already in different countries who were using it for documenting activities for making films. In fact, we managed to find one person, Richard Leacock, who was a pioneer in Super 8 filmmaking. And he came here, we did workshops with him, and sort of tried to expose people to the alternate possibilities. So that was a... But as a NGO, as a non-profit organization, we were also concerned on how to make our bread and butter, how to earn a living. So one of our first things was we managed to persuade the Moria Hotel to install a closed circuit television system for guests' entertainment within the hotel. This was the first ever in the country. And for that we needed to incorporate engineers, you know, technicians, and so that's where our technical sort of team grew. And we also fed into this thing, besides showing whatever film material was already available, we'd also produce stuff for the closed circuit thing, for the hotel.
What kind of material did you produce for the hotel?
A lot of it was like music and dance and, you know, Indian sort of cultural sort of stuff. Because, I mean, we felt that this is what people in, you know, foreigners staying in the Moria Hotel would like to see. I mean, other people could see Hindi films if that's what they wanted.
Okay,
so that's one stream. One stream was research, and then the Super 8 production. Then serendipitously, we bumped into some person in Delhi who had one of the first ever video cameras, portable video.
VTR.
Yeah. And he was on an assignment with FAO to document Indian agricultural practices or something. So we helped him and we hit it off. I took him around to some rural areas and he did his recording. But at the end of it, he gave us his camera. So we were able to do our own recording, video recordings. At that time, the only video recording was in big television studios, gigantic equipment. So we continued our research in a bunch of villages around Saharanpur. I have a connection there, so you know, that's why we chose that area. And so what we do, we shoot stuff and then play it back in the evening and then talk to people about, you know, what they liked, what they want. And the next step was to actually give cameras to people under supervision of our technicians and friends to let them record what they wanted to record and see what they did, and also they'd play it back and see what kind of things worked, what kind of things didn't work. So there were all kinds of interesting things. I think we were among the first to discover reality TV, because we, you know, we let people shoot the stuff, and they shot, you know, a lot of the kind of things that now are mainstream, you know. They shot themselves doing Bombay films, songs or dances. But the more interesting thing was shooting discussions. So they discuss problems, local issues, and so then, I mean, as you know, Indian villages can be highly stratified. So, you know, the poor guy may not be able to speak to the zamindar, to the or the low caste, to the Brahmin, or all these various stratifications. So what we tried to do was to use video as a means, one is to people to express themselves, and then is to communicate with another set of people in front of whom did not dare to speak or unable to. And the next stage was to, once we got a sort of consensus about on local issues, was to take these tapes to the government. You know, if there's a problem relating to the, let's say, the block, then we take the tape to the block BDO and show him the tape and explain what the issue was, and occasionally some action did take place after that. So we did a lot of this. Well, just an anecdote. During the emergency, we took a bunch of villagers from Saharanpur to Mrs. Gandhi's house. A friend had a three, so you know, so we set up a camera in Mrs. Gandhi's house, and then these villagers, when she came in, they tried to ask her some questions, but she threw us out. Said, "How did you people get here? And, you know, how can you people come here like this?" And all, and we got thrown out. But it, you know, it's just an example of the kind of things we were into. Okay, so that's one line and thing. Then we were sort of pioneers in the NGO sector who were concerned with communication and media. So we worked with a lot of other NGOs or social movements and helped them document or make films about their issues, you know, whatever issues really concerned them. So we, you know, helped a lot of people. People did stuff on the Bhopal gas thing. Then the Narmada Valley Andolan. So a lot of people we helped document that and make films on it. And a lot of NGOs like the Social Work and Research Center and all over the country we helped. And then we did a lot of training programs for people who worked with NGOs or people who belonged to NGOs so they could do their own thing. But that, by this time, you know, video had become quite reasonably accessible. You know. I mean, this could well be just VHS, not Betamax or those Betacam or those kind of things. But it was adequate for the purpose. Because we sincerely believed that it was easier to train a person who was concerned with an issue to make some document the issue than to train a filmmaker to understand the issue and make something meaningful. So we then the next step was also distribution. We had all these NGOs who had started making videos. So we tried to make a network so that tapes could be exchanged. So we did a thing we called the Communication Resources Network, which it exchanged videos and organized training programs and so on and so forth. And then we got involved in women's issues became a big thing. So we did a lot of stuff with training programs for women, workshops for women, and this was on a regional basis. So we had women from Pakistan, Bangladesh, you know, Nepal, all these different countries, and we did a number of these programs. Then we got having done all this, we got involved in an international level of people working with videos concerned with the democratization of communication. So we formed an international organization called Vidyazimuth, we'd have international seminars, symposiums, conferences in different continents where people would talk about their problems and, you know, whatever work was happening in the field of alternative communication. So I think that's a very broad sort of thing, yeah.
Because it has, thanks for this, because it has actually opened up a few things I would like to ask about.
Sure.
So, one is the three very distinct areas that Sendit was working in.
Mm-hmm.
But before I get there, I mean, so early 70s, if Sendit started, does Sendit still do any work in any form? Or
sorry?
Does Sendit still work in any form? No.
Now?
No.
No, no. It's,
when was the last active?
I think the end of 1990s, yeah. Basically, I mean, I'm a old-fashioned leftist. I believe institutions are set up for a mission, a purpose, and not to perpetuate themselves. So by the end of 90s, I thought our mission was done. I mean, if today anybody can make a film, anybody can sing, so what we dreamt about is happening. Of course, the socio-political situation hasn't changed radically, so, you know, it's only people with resources can do all these things. But that's another battle.
So to come back to this, from the 70s to 90s period, which is almost about three decades, you talked about how from film to Super 8 to then, of course, other formats would have come in.
Videos,
yeah, in the videos.
You know, 3/4 inch, that became the sort of standard for us, you know.
So when you say 3/4 inch, you mean?
U-matic.
So, how was the choice made to shift from Super 8 to 3/4 inch, for example? What was happening in those days?
Well, it's very obvious that there's no comparison in the sense that Super 8, you film it, then you send it to for processing, and then, you know, editing is such a drag, you know, the whole thing. With video, you just shoot it, play it back immediately.
So, why the choice of the U-matic, for example? Were you looking at any other? Was it because the market around was also looking at 3/4 inch?
No, at that time, that seemed the most viable, high-quality stuff. I mean, we were also working with VHS directly, but things which had a more wider appeal, we used U-matic. That was an acceptable standard, even for television. I mean, some of our programs were on television also.
So then, when you're moving to these technologies, the kind of people who are working on them, like you said earlier, you would prefer to work with people who were in the field, who knew the situation well enough. You found that they could be trained and they knew what they wanted to talk about better than asking a filmmaker to come and do it. But they had to be introduced to the technology. So can you just kind of give us a sense of how this, if I can call it a training or introduction to people who had no clue about a technology like this, would how it would work, to making them like operators and technicians and people who became proficient in it over time? What was the process by which that happened?
Well, you know, from the beginning, I mean, one of our founders was an engineer, and he wasn't, I think he was from an IIT or something, so he was a full-fledged, proper engineer. He joined UNICEF later and moved to New York or something. Then after that, we had another chap, Rajiv Mehrotra. I mean, he helped set up the Maurya thing. And then after Maurya, he wanted us to do more of these hotel type things. But, you know, at Sendit we are not interested. So he set up his own company and did hotels, a lot of hotels, a lot of things. And I forget, the company is quite well known at that time.
PSPT.
नहीं नहीं उसकी कंपनी थी कमर्शियल कंपनी ये सब इनका राजस्थान में ही बेस था
शायद बाद में हुआ होगा
राजीव मथुरा
बाद में ये
पीएसबी टीवी से नहीं
नहीं ये नहीं ये नहीं, अलग 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 है ये
okay.
ये तो प्योरली कमर्शियल ये कर रहा था
एंड द आईआईटी इंजीनियर वाज व्हाट इज द नेम ऑफ द इंजीनियर फ्रॉम
अंशुदास
अंशुदास
नो सो दीस गाइस trained people, you know. The one of their main jobs and most things was to train other people to do all these things. I mean, we had these equipment, but it's not that there were people out there who could come and fix it, repair it or something. So we had to develop in-house abilities to repair all the equipment. And whenever we got equipment, we made sure we had enough spares and things so that things could be...
Which actually brings me to a... So is there any kind of one of the things the archive has to talk about the development of science and technology in India? Mm. Any examples of documentation of... Because this is a very interesting area, how to train people who weren't engineers into this, into becoming operators and technicians. So a sense of what kind of training was done through maybe some documentation of that time ki course mein kya padhaya jayega or some notes or instructions something like that would you have because it would be great if you could see some of those
okay let me see
we can do it later if you want
me yahan pe isi dabbe mein hai na
haan jo dekh lenge abhi
we'll finish the conference we'll do that as I'll just make a note of it to look karke to look in box It's great. It's happening. Because that's a very important thing. You know, then you get a sense of the kind of way teaching was done by looking at documents like that. So that would be very useful for our purpose. But having said that, let's move on to another point that came up. You were pioneers in NGO communication in a sense, which means you are meeting lots of people who are aware of the usefulness of video communication but don't really know how to go about getting it done.
Well, a lot of them were not really aware of video communication possibilities. So first you had to convert them.
Oh, so how was that done?
No, but showing them stuff and seeing how other people had used it. And at that time, I don't know, in the early 70s, there was a lot of very dedicated NGOs who were, and we used to have a lot of meetings of NGOs and discuss all kinds of things. There's still a post-Gandhian sort of thing where, you know, NGOs were considered a good thing, not somebody who was anti-state, anti-Hindu or whatever.
So then, so you're saying part of it was because of the sustained meetings or continuous meetings that was happening with...
Yeah, and the social climate was, you know, except for that brief emergency period.
So, are there any kind of an incident which could describe how a particular group who had no awareness of how a communication like this could be useful, understood and then asked you to do something as a kind of anecdote, if you can remember.
There's so many of them, I can't really pin anything
okay.
down really.
So in case later kuch dhyan aa jaye something, but we'll talk about it later. I'm saying, for example, you talked about Bhopal, Narmada, Andolan, SWRC.
CMS, the Chhattisgarh Mazdoor
thing,
CMS, that was...
CMS, so, mines, Chhattisgarh mines and...
So, in places like this, because Bhopal, Narmada Andolan, CMS, there are actually Andolans of different kinds.
Yeah, there
is...
They're not NGOs.
They're not NGOs. No. They're like people's movements. They're very different. SWRC is a different kind of thing.
Yeah.
So then the kind of way you interacted with these two kinds of groups would have also been different. What was the difference?
No, basically, these sort of things, it's people came to us, you know.
Mm.
In the sense, there were people who were already activists,
mm.
who were involved with those issues, with those things. And they came to us because we had equipment and we had, you know, facilities to help them. So, these are not conceived by us as such. It's people who came to us and, you know,
so which then, if I'm led to think then, that part of the way Sendit worked and also a kind of the way the technology got used was when, by keeping your doors open to let people come to you.
Absolutely. It was a sort of a resource center where, you know, activists and, you know, people concerned with issues could come and...
So then, so you're working like as a resource, as technological resource center in a sense.
Well, technological, also ideological. It's not that we...
I mean, it would be, were there any, since you mentioned the word ideology,
mm.
were there any other similar groups elsewhere in the country at the time Sendit was?
Not media ones.
Mm.
But later on a few did develop.
So the idea of the ideological slash technological center is unique, clearly. But more than that, if you can talk, you know, because it's connected to the way technology gets used,
mm.
and therefore I'd like you to just say a little bit about, in your, when you look back at it, what were the things that actually made Sendit become the kind of place it was?
I think it's all, a lot of it is accidents, you know. It's not that we set out with a clear plan that this is what will happen. But, you know, we were like a boat on the ocean, and going with the waves, and, you know, and steering it, trying to steer our best we can. A lot of things just happened. We didn't know that video would happen and suddenly all this would happen. And we never knew phones would become such a thing.
But the fact that you were a boat in the ocean, you had a particular kind of crew who knew how to crew that boat, which is not a ship, it was still a boat that would move with the waves.
Mm-hmm.
So that means it would not require certain kinds of inputs, but you would require other kinds. So, for example, if you can, I mean, we have Kailash sitting right
mm-hmm.
here. His introduction to the place and how he kind of grew himself as a person mm-hmm. and as a person in this industry. But more than that, what kind of way, in what ways did Sendit allow that to happen? When you look at a specific case like this, I mean, doors are open for one, it's very big.
But see, basically, the Sendit was a sort of a training ground, I think, for people. So people would come, they'd have heard about Sendit somewhere, so they'd come and basically I'd look for a certain social consciousness, a certain social commitment. That was the only qualification that I looked for. And they'd come and they'd be like interns. And they'd work with people who had already been doing stuff. And after a while, a lot of them went on to greener pastures, because we could only afford to pay a pittance, you know. And as the industry grew, there was lots more money to be made in Times TV or whatever, you know.
More than.
Correct.
And Kailash will can tell you more directly about, you know, the technical training part of it.
We've had some conversations with him, also with others as well. We will have more. One part that is now becoming even more intriguing is about the research. How did research feed into all of this? Your research part at Sendit. How did that feed into the other work Sendit was doing?
Not research. I mean, one is the basic communication research. So that's the whole basis of everything we did. You know?
So you actually, when you use the word research here, I want to kind of, because it's not a kind of research we do anymore nowadays. A lot of communications research is like finding out who's watching which channel, and that you don't even, the human being is not involved in that. I mean, it's all electronically kind of thing. So.
I'll show you some documents
of,
you know, research reports and stuff.
We can have a look at some of that. So I think what we can do now is maybe before we get into this, because a whole set of questions will come out of when we look at that. But before that, the working environment of a place like Sendit would be very different from like a commercial kind of profit-oriented company. It also is the reason why people felt they could come to Sendit with a request of which they couldn't think of going to others. What was that working environment? What were you trying to create essentially?
Well, you know, one, it was a total open plan sort of thing. Everybody sat on similar desks in the same shared space. So there wasn't that kind of a hierarchy.
Visibly, there was no working hierarchy, there was not much visible. Was there a hierarchy between people who worked with the machines and people who didn't work with the machines? Or everybody got a chance?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's not something I could answer because I'm, you know, that's not my...
Okay.
I mean, Kailash is the person who can... But true, I mean, there was a sort of... the people who were on the, let's say, the production side and all that tended to be more highly educated and more anglicized, you know. They were from a different, let's say, class background, while the technicians were more rooted in the ground, you know. I mean, a lot of them had no formal qualifications at all. They learned on the job.
Okay. And when you're saying they learned on the job, means they had some previous sense of like family working in a particular thing, some other skill which translated into a skill. I mean, a skill essentially is like knowing materials and how they work.
I think some of them had some background in electric sort of stuff and things like that, but a lot of them were...
Okay. So I'll then... We'll take a pause for now.
Yeah.
We'll look at the materials and then some questions will arise from there. So we'll continue it like that. Okay. So let's take a pause.